What's up, Foos? Main Event Jey Uso here from the WWE. When it's just me between matches, it's day one-ish. And that means it's Chumba time. With hundreds of casino-style games and new titles arriving weekly, there's always something fresh to try at Chumba Casino. The daily boosts make it even more fun. And have me, about to get them, all during my downtime. Ready for a fun way to chill out and enjoy a few minutes for yourself? Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
This is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
Ukraine conflict. Telegraph reporting from London. Russia's top general has visited the front lines in Ukraine's south, according to the defense ministry in Moscow. As the Kremlin troops suffered from battle fatigue and ammunition shortages, Valery Gerasimov, the chief of general staff of Russia's armed forces, was shown in a windowless bunker, poring over maps and receiving briefings in a one-minute video released to the ministry. The general, who earlier took personal command of occupational forces in Ukraine, was then filmed climbing into a helicopter marked with the Russian Z symbol. I welcome Colonel Jeff McCausland, United States Army retired artilleryman, CBS News, visiting professor at Dickinson College, as well as the CEO of Diamond Six Leadership and Strategy, to comment on the suspicion in the Telegraph story and elsewhere that Gerasimov is not walking with the troops, that he's a rear area general, that since the beginning of the war, he has not provided leadership or inspiration to his troops. That is part of the complaint we heard from Prigozhin, who himself is a disgraceful pirate. But in any event, he understands morale. He was with his troops in Bakhmut. We saw the video. We've not seen anything comparable of Gerasimov. And Prigozhin denounced Gerasimov as well as Shoigu in that mutiny weekend. Jeff, a very good evening to you. You've been to command school. You've commanded commanders. What is the commander's role in a combat situation such as this? What do you expect of him? What is he expected to do of it by his own subordinates? Good evening to you.
Good evening, John. First of all, we always used to say an officer is always on parade. And what soldiers expect first and foremost from their officers is they set the example. They're the ones that set the example to everybody else. They eat last. They are available. They are true to their men. They care for their men, particularly when they're in combat. And, of course, I command in combat and know that full well. From that is derived trust, and for that is derived combat effectiveness. And throughout this conflict, the last 17, 18 months, we have seen almost no evidence of General Gerasimov, even as commander of all the operations in Ukraine, showing up at the front. He is commanding this force from Moscow. He used to say in Vietnam, this is like leading the war from Washington to Vietnam using a 5,000-mile screwdriver and trying to turn the screw. And consequently, I don't think there's that much faith and confidence in the officers, soldiers, and NCOs in the Russian army in their leadership. He mentioned Prigozhin, and Prigozhin frequently called Gerasimov and Shoigu, the Minister of Defense, cowards for their inability to do that, cowards for their failure to take care of the troop, cowards for their failure to provide them the logistical support they needed, while he himself was frequently at the front with the Wagner group, much as he is the thug that you just described. He was physically there, sometimes surrounded by even dead Wagner fighters who've been killed in combat. So this, I think, is really a poor example of the Kremlin trying to create a narrative to actually make Gerasimov look better. That is particularly important in the aftermath of this aborted putsch by Prigozhin, which clearly Gerasimov was undermined without question. And in those few moments after Prigozhin began his march for justice, as he called it, towards Moscow, Gerasimov, Shoigu, they were all missing in action at a critical moment as well. And so now we're trying to, I think, in Moscow, buttress his image in the eyes of the Russian people, buttress his image in the eyes of the Russian army. But it looks to me like a failed narrative. And particularly when you compare that to recent film that has shown President Zelensky, for example, surrounded by his soldiers at the front in Bakhmut.
I recover Zarovikin and Popov, two generals who have been disappeared. Zarovikin, who was at the front line commanding combat troops, he did the same in Syria. He's gone, General Armageddon. Popov, speaking out of turn, is now gone as well. So Gerasimov is not only not appearing with the troops, he's removing from command structure men who are in the fight, who are showing themselves, and yet because of their suspect disloyalty or inaction with Prigozhin, they've been removed. Jeff, this means that it's not just the troops who would be discouraged. It would be the general staff. Is that a fair projection?
I think that's absolutely correct. And the one thing that they have done, Sorovikin may have clearly known about Prigozhin's plans, and that's why he was removed. But to some degree as well, I think he and Popov, for sure, made the big error of telling truth to power. And they, many ways, echoed many of the things that Prigozhin had said about the failure of the Ministry of Defense, the failure of the general staff, albeit, and of course, General Gerasimov and Minister Shoigu, for not providing the support for the troops, rotating the troops, et cetera. So they were saying the same things. And for saying those things, speaking truth to power, they were removed from their particular positions. So what does that tell us? What that tells us is the leadership in the Russian Federation now values personal loyalty to the leader far above it of operational effectiveness. Don't tell us the truth. Tell us what we want to hear. Support the narrative that this so-called special military technical operation for 18 months is going swimmingly, because that's the narrative, sadly, curiously, or unbelievably, that Moscow is still trying to play out to the Russian people.
All these months later, Jeff, I'm reading a new book by Serhiy Plokhy, the Ukrainian history professor at Harvard University. It is repeatedly made clear in the early days of the war that the Russian general staff was ill-informed, unprepared, that a total failure in Russian intelligence. They expected to overwhelm the country in 2 or 3 days. Hence, the frontline troops who came in from Belarus only carried 2 or 3 days of rations. When they got into Ukrainian cities, they pilfered the stores. They broke into kitchens because they were hungry men. That's a failure of Gerasimov. That's a failure of Shoigu, correct?
Absolutely correct. Don't forget, those troops, when they began that offensive on about the 22nd of February in 2022, they had been sitting out there in the field in the wintertime on the border of Ukraine for 2 or 3 months already, suffering, you know, shortages of food, suffering shortages of heat, obviously, clothing, et cetera, when that offensive was finally begun. And the clear assumption that this was going to be an easy victory was demonstrated by the fact that we've had intelligence reports where Russian officers were told, make sure and pack your dress uniforms because you're going to need your dress uniform in a couple of days for the victory parade in Kyiv, which never happened. Now, I only hope, John, if those officers are still living, which probably most of them are not, they're still lugging those dress uniforms around 17 months later.
We go to the battlefield. Again, the puzzle of what is the Ukrainian intention. It still looks very much like Bakhmut is an offensive aspect of it, but not the primary one. It's draining in Russian troops to continue to hold what line they can. The main battle axis looks to be straight up the middle towards the Sea of Azov. Do you see any change, Jeff, in these days since we last talked?
I do see a change in two ways, John. First of all, I think the Ukrainian strategy is described by someone who is to starve, stretch, and then strike. Starve the Russians by trying to use longer range fires to strike at their logistical base, deprive them of fuel, deprive them of ammunition. And we've seen a number of longer range strikes by the Ukrainians against supply lines of the Russian Federation. Stretch by forcing the Russians, having multiple avenues advance, to stretch their forces and try to find those places where they can then strike. That being said, this offensive by the counteroffensive by the Ukrainians still has enormous problems. One is, of course, the Russians' ability over 6 months to create very, very significant defenses, the so-called Sorovikin line, which in some places may be 10 miles or more in depth with minefields, tank traps, trenches, barbed wire, et cetera. And this then channelizes Ukrainian forces that try to make their way across those minefields where they open them up, which then allows them, because of observation from drones, to be hit by indirect fire. Second of all, of course, this, John, is the only offensive I can think of, and you're a better historian than I, since the advent of the 20th century, where an offensive force was attacking while it did not even have local air superiority to count upon. So air superiority is clearly maintained by the Russians, and we're seeing the Russians, as the Ukrainians begin this counteroffensive, being more effective in learning about the use, particularly of their helicopters, against advancing Ukrainian forces. The only historical example I can see where that was effective, John, might have been the winter of 1944, the Ardennes Offensive, the Battle of Bulge, initially by the Germans. We both know that occurred because the weather was horrible, which grounded a lot of the Allied air support. So the Ukrainians have got to get over that particular problem. And as a consequence, rather than get into an attrition warfare with the Russians, which the Russians have far more manpower, I think the Ukrainians are being a bit more circumspect in trying to get into that, knowing full well they do not have the manpower, and therefore being more trying to find that breach where they can expand their operations. And then, of course, we're seeing escalation by them. We'll talk more. And that is the use of drones to strike the Russian capital, Moscow, and the use of sea drones to attack the Black Sea Fleet.
Yes, the drones are a twist, although we've seen them introduced in the battlefield for some time. President Zelensky said over the weekend, we will attack Russia. I don't know, Jeff. It wasn't clear to me. I don't have the Ukrainian. Whether he means the drones are attacking Russia or whether he's talking about launching operations towards Rostov to cut off the line. How do you hear him saying we will attack Russia?
I think initially it will be with the drones. Because we've seen repeated drones over the last several days against Moscow, even striking one building twice. The Ministry of the Economics, they also struck near against an intelligence headquarters and against the naval headquarters. But striking one building twice, I think, suggests to people in Moscow, these people have the ability to target a specific spot and do it repeatedly. And furthermore, they're able to do this even though we have large-scale air defenses because the drones travel under the air defense network around Moscow, which is largely aimed against missile forces. So the Ukrainians, to some degree, I think, are escalating the war by the use of the drones, escalating the war territorial, as you said, take it to Russia. In fact, I think Mr. Zelensky's exact words were something like that. Moscow needs to get used to a full-fledged war. And this is obviously, I think, the intent to have on the willpower of the Russian people. The Russian forces have tried to hit the willpower of the Ukrainian people by striking the cities, critical infrastructure, electric power grid, now trying to destroy their ability to export grain. The goal, though, is to break the willpower of the Ukrainian people. And now we see the Ukrainians, I think, responding, psychologically at least, by telling the Moscow population, you now are vulnerable. We can strike you whenever we want to. And we can do that in a very precise fashion.
Once again, the rhetoric from the leadership in the Kremlin is mentioning nuclear weapons. I believe Medvedev, the former president, former prime minister, talking about using nukes. I'm beginning to hear this nuke line as wolf, wolf, Jeff. It's sort of like if you didn't give him a big enough tip, he'd threaten you with a nuclear weapon. I don't see how a nuclear weapon could possibly fit into the Russian plans to reclaim whatever they say is theirs. So are you beginning to get numb at these nuclear threats? We no longer see stark headlines whenever Medvedev speaks.
Yeah, I certainly am. I think, again, this is part of the game of controlling the narrative. At the same time, of course, the Russian narrative is the counteroffensive is not working. Second part of the Russian narrative is none of these drones are working. Well, if you strike the same building twice, you're undermining that particular narrative. And now we have the narrative of the nuclear weapons. And if you do that, we're going to escalate, which is one we've heard over and over. So it's sort of like a boy crying wolf.
Yeah.
That being said, of course, Russian doctrine says what? If Russian territory or the existence of the Russian Federation is threatened, we will respond to nuclear weapons. That has been their longstanding doctrine. Having, in fact, formally annexed these four provinces, even though they don't control the territory of those four provinces, a successful Ukrainian counteroffensive that would seem to threaten their control of those four provinces could be construed by them as threatening the existence of the Federation, which one would argue then leads to that particular eventuality of nuclear weapons. But I think you're right. You're spot on, John. Operationally, I don't see where that provides you any advantage. Politically, perhaps it does. If you say, if we do that, that's the last warning to get NATO to back off. But I'm pretty certain that the Russian leadership is not willing to take that step. Having said that, I think we have to acknowledge very soberly, John, that's not an absolute. Is there a chance they could escalate? As long as they have the capability, that chance certainly exists.
We're going to the Belarus-Polish border. Colonel Jeff McCausland, CBS News. I'm John Batchelor.
Lots of places can expose you to identity theft. That's why LifeLock monitors hundreds of millions of data points a second for threats to your identity, which is way more than anyone can do on their own. If we find anything suspicious, like new loans or changes to your financial accounts, we alert you right away, all through text, phone, email, or the LifeLock app. Save up to 30% your first year. Visit LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here, and I have discovered a fun new escape from the daily grind, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has hundreds of social casino-style games that's all free to play anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So get to ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21+.